Okay, this is talking with Pat O'Brien on 31st May 1981 over the phone from Cambridge to his home in London. So if I could start off by asking you, what was your educational background, and when did you first come into contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I was actually born in South Africa.
Yes.
I came over in 1950, very early in January.
1950?
What happened was I was working on the ionosphere in South Africa and did a one-year master's degree on it.
Yes.
With some really elementary research. And I won a scholarship to go abroad and chose to go to the ionospheric school at Cambridge.
I see.
So that was really the easy contact. So when I arrived, I had an interview with Rector. Said, well, you know, you come to do ionospheric work, so you work, you know, with any of the groups that are here.
It was your choice?
It was my choice. And he was very nice to me. He said that I could work with the long wave group or the short wave group or whatever. But he said, we also have a very new group here.
Okay, let me just... So you were saying that that Ratcliffe said that he had this new radio astronomy group.
Yes, that's right.
And can you remember how he described it? I'd be interested in that.
Oh, well, I can't remember the exact words, of course. But he did describe it as being new and exciting. And he actually said that it was headed by Ryle, who was a genius.
Uh-huh.
I went out and spoke to all the different people, including Ryle and Weeks and Briggs, that's where they must have been.
Yes.
Can't remember them all now. And it was pretty clear to me, you know, that Ryle, the Ryle group was the most exciting group there.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a particular inclination you had towards astronomy then? That...
No, not at all. The ionospheric connection was originally largely chance. It happened to be the line of research in the department I was working in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn led to another chance thing of working with Ryle.
Now, which department actually was it in South Africa that you...
Oh, I was from the Rhodes University in Grahamstown.
Mm-hmm. And you had done some postgraduate work there, or is that a...
Well, it was pretty low-level postgraduate. It was a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
For 1 year.
I see. Okay, well, now getting back to Cambridge, so that in the fall of 1950, would this be that you...
This was in January 1950.
Okay, that you joined the group.
So I joined the group, yes.
And what are your impressions of those first couple of months with the group?
Well, it was, I thought in a way I was a bit overawed by the Cavendish. You know, the Cavendish has such a fantastic name.
Right.
Had in those days. It was very much, it all looked so terribly old. You know, the Cavendish looked old physically. Sort of felt old.
Right.
And the actual group itself, seemed to be working very much on a shoestring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The labs were very crowded, facilities were not exactly lavish.
Right.
It was all that kind of thing. It was a very nice atmosphere. I liked the people immediately.
Right.
And everybody was on very, very friendly first name terms and sort of jokey, pleasant atmosphere. Yeah, I enjoyed being there.
Right. And now how does one begin as a new research student in the group? Were you set off to read for a month or two, or what?
I obviously had to start reading. Yes, they gave me papers to read, showing what they'd already done. But at the same time, I started joining in immediately, doing the helping other people. Because it was very much a group where you all mucked in together.
Right.
And yeah. There was no care distinction between different people, because to do an experiment, you had to have other people to help you.
Right.
Get on with
that. Yeah, you mentioned that in your thesis about thanking all the people that moved your aerials around. And
yes, well, I used to move aerials for other people, and then they moved aerials for me.
Right.
And we used to go out and cut the grass, and cableways, do all sorts of things.
Now, what was the project that you began working on first? Can you remember which?
Well, I suppose the main one was what they used to call fast wires, which were the capacity-loaded dipoles.
Right. And you have an appendix in your thesis, in fact, that...
appendix about it. They actually, summing up quite quickly, were a bit of a failure. rain because of the weather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, I read about the difficulties with them in other theses also. And in fact, I was interested to find in your thesis that Joe Pausi had a patent on the idea. I hadn't known that before. But which aerial was this working with?
Which aerial? Well, what I started doing really, if I remember rightly, was to start on 7.9 meters. Nobody had done anything on 7.9 meters up to that point. And I was also helping Ken Mach, who I was working on the 3.7 stuff.
Right.
So I did things like building pre-amplifiers. And getting the set going, and calibrating things, using cables, all matching things up, all very tedious.
Right, right.
On transmission lines. I built a phase, I did phase switching.
This was the 3.7 meter one?
I did the 7.9 meter one. The actual switch was in a box. It was a capacity switch. And it had very, I can't remember the details again, but it had various, you had to match it up very carefully. You know?
Right.
Short little bit of cable, so I'll measure it on a good transmission line. And that, I remember, spent quite a long time on that, because it had to be done really, really carefully.
So you really began almost from the beginning going to this new longer wavelength?
Yes, I can't tell you exactly when it was, but I certainly did that quite early on.
And was this a decision that had been made by Ryle that this would be a good thing to do, or do you remember how the idea came up to do this?
I don't honestly remember that. I mean, when you first appear in that, you're not really aware of the decision-making process.
Right, right. Right.
No, that was very much a feeling of sort of joining in the general work, helping out at the field lab out of Grange Road.
Mm-hmm.
And there was quite a lot of routine work that had to be done, changing the, on a very mundane level, changing the charts on the recorders.
Right.
Changing the paper rolls, checking the head, doing the time checks, all that kind of
thing. Right. And everybody chipped in on, no matter whose experiment it was.
Oh, yes, it was very, very much a...
But now, it seems then that you began immediately on what was to become your dissertation work, is that correct?
Yes, I didn't use absolutely immediately. I'm sorry to be vague about this. I said, I got a terrible memory. I warned you, this wouldn't be a very satisfactory interview. And things then, I'm not absolutely clear on that. I don't know really exactly when I first started on that.
But in any case, you didn't work on another project as a trial thing or something like that?
No.
Yeah. And can you remember at the time what your feeling was as to the state of knowledge about the sun at radio waves?
Well, that's a good question. Well, broadly speaking, my interest then was in quiet sun, which was what Stanley had been trying to measure the distribution across the sun. And it was really a question, I suppose, of continuing with that. To try and get a body of information at various wavelengths on the distribution of emission over the disk. You know?
Right.
And then this would be material from which one could use as a basis for theories about temperature, electron density distribution.
Right. Were you also stimulated by the fact that solar minimum was coming up and you could better do this?
Yes, that was certainly a factor, yes. So I think Stanier had some trouble with sunspots, but I can't remember that.
Yeah, he did, right.
And we were certainly moving into a period of the cycle, sure. Yeah, that must have been a factor.
Right. Tell me then how you proposed to find out what the distribution of the quiet sun radiation was.
Well, it was really just a continuation of the technique that Tanya had used, which I take it you read about.
Yes, and in fact I interviewed him a few weeks ago.
It was really a question of using the same basic technique at first, the variable spacing barometer, varying the aperture, doing one measurement, let's say, and then let's say doing another measurement at the spacing.
Except you were at a much longer wavelength.
Except had different wavelength altogether. The aerials were entirely different. He had used small dishes.
Right.
Whereas we were using a dipole array. Instead, we kind of carted around physically. You know. Except the 7.9 meter one was actually fixed. It was a quarter reflector.
And you also had to worry much more about the galactic background at that long wavelength.
Yes, galactic background really only came in when dealing, when trying to calibrate the thing absolutely. But, the whole sequence of things was the phase switching.
Well, that's what I say, in the sense that you did that. I don't think that Stanier had the phase switching. I'm not sure about that, but...
I'm not sure about it either. I mean, I should perhaps say that one of the big things at that time was the phase switching interferometer. I'm not sure exactly when it was devised, but it must have been in the late 40s.
Right, it was just about the time that you arrived, I think.
That's what, yes, it was very much in the air. And this was the secret of the whole business, of doing it at long wave, you know, to eliminate the exact spectrum.
Right, right.
We'll have to fix those kind of things that we use.
Now, the automatic gain control that one had, which meant that you had to then go back and calibrate how much the galactic background was contributing. Can you tell me what was the electronic reason for having that automatic gain control?
I'm not sure that I can.
I mean, was the level of operation of the amplifiers so critical that if it changed by a factor of two that you'd
I don't think it was. I don't think I can really answer that adequately, actually. I never, all the electronics had really been designed by the time I got there.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I ever got involved in was looking at the preamp. And the basic set had already been designed. People like Machen and von Berg and so on. And
yeah.
Well, had done all that. So I really paid very much attention to that, quite honestly.
Okay, well, I'll ask someone up at the Cavendish. I realized as I was reading this that I wasn't quite sure what the real advantages of that were.
I just can't think offhand.
Because it was a bit of a problem to calibrate it to having that kind of a system.
It would just so happen that the graphic background is very, very strong.
Right.
But I think it's quite possible that I didn't even realize that point when I started out.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
It was supposed to be pointed out to me by reliable information.
Now, the difference, of course, in what you did, besides being a longer wavelength, was that you did cuts across the sun at different angles.
Yes, that was the new thing, really. Yes.
And now, was that really anything different in terms of the observations, or was it really quite straightforward how this had to be done and how it was going to be converted into a model?
Well, the practical difficulties were we had a very long, narrow sight.
Right.
So it was really east-west.
Right.
Well, not exactly. And there was very little north-south that was at all. So you couldn't bring the azimuth around very, very, very much physically.
Right.
So it really had to be done by looking at the sun at different times of day.
Right.
Which, of course, is really the essence of apodism.
Exactly.
And although that stage, that was, didn't really think about it quite like that. And so there were limitations, I mean, depending on the time of the year and that kind of thing. But it's okay. There's no tremendous problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a very interesting paragraph in your thesis in which you say that, this could obviously be done, and you could measure the phase instantaneously and put together a map if you put them all on railroad, on rails.
Yeah, that's right. What we were doing was really extremely primitive, I mean, if you look back on it. I'm just picking up the aerial and walking along and plonking down somewhere else.
Right. Well, everything has to start somewhere.
Yeah, it was the old kind of string team left. Then it was kind of funny with ours was angle iron and concrete.
Right, right. the other thing I was struck by was that you did a tremendous amount of observations over something like a 2-year period. and you numbered these experiments 1 to 13 or something like that. Was the purpose of that simply because you were interested in seeing how things varied over the solar cycle, or was it simply that there were so many wavelengths you wanted to operate at and it just took that long?
Well, I suppose there was a lot of interest in what would happen over a period of time. You know, there's always something that was unexpected. But what was clearly unsatisfactory in the early experiments was the fact that you were doing experiments over a longish time. You could only do one observation a day. And then you had to wait for another one and so on. And of course, you didn't always have the equipment available.
Right.
It was a cable, whatever. And it became clear that as time went on, that it was changing anyway, you know, with time.
Mm-hmm.
So then we got on to the idea of trying to do the whole thing in one day. And I think one or two of those experiments were done within a day, if I remember right.
Right. Now, what did that imply in terms of a observing schedule and so forth?
Oh, you mean how it would actually work out?
Yeah, right. I mean, operationally.
I mean, the one that I did was the day was done with a page, the actual places where the areas were going to be situated, all had to be surveyed accurately.
Right.
So we just knocked on angle line on the ground and held it, and then you brought the aerial along and put it into slots, you know, bolted it in.
Right.
Very quickly. And then you moved it to another position and another position and so on. That was all done with long, all arranged beforehand, and it just meant a long day's work with quite a lot of people helping out, and working non-stop.
So you would, how many people would it take to move this thing, first of all?
Well, let's see, I would certainly do smaller areas. I know there was 1.4 people, I'd do that with two. Yes, I think two could probably have done that. The 3.7-meter ones were much bigger. They were at least four people, I would say.
They look like they're about 10 feet high from the photograph.
Yes, they were higher than that. The 3.7-meter ones were really quite high.
So this meant that you had to have four people on duty the entire day.
Yes, although that's a big experiment. It was actually done at 1.4. I think probably we got away with two people on that one. And there must have been some kind of schedule where, and I was there all the time, of course. There must have been a schedule where other people kind of helped me sometimes.
And you would stay at each position until you felt like you had the fringe amplitude.
Okay, it depends either running, you either had to run physically back to the lab and see what was happening on the chart, you know. Or you had to kind of, somebody had to be there, and we had a telephone there.
Mm-hmm.
With a little box at the end of the field.
Right.
And you just sit there with the cranking away on the telephone, talking to somebody. To make sure it all worked properly before you went to the next position.
Right, right. Now, one thing I was a bit surprised about was you had a nice figure showing you published this actually in Monthly Notices also, showing the fringe at the different spacings at the 1.4 meters, I guess it was. And I was surprised that you didn't stay longer to really establish what it was. It seemed like it was really the minimal amount of information that one could have any confidence that you really had the amplitude of it there. Was it simply because you were so rushed to get all these spacings in?
You mean just one fringe?
Yeah, or even a half a fringe, it looks like.
Yes. Well, what we used to do there was put in a half wave cable, didn't we? Half wave length?
Yes.
Something like that. Well, yes, it was a tremendous rush to get them all in, you know. And actually, the trouble is that at the shortest spacing, it takes a long time to get a fringe.
Right.
And it was quite a business getting it all in one day.
So you had to make a compromise between the obvious desirability of having several fringes and wanting to get all the spacings in.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, in the early experiments, some of the others, where you could just do one spacing in one day, you just had the thing running all the time.
Right. But then you had this uncertainty about day-to-day variations.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah.
Certainly, we're there.
Well, That was something else that struck me as I was reading this. You were comparing with the earlier results of Estanir and Machen, and you seemed reasonably confident that things had changed over the solar cycle, but how was it that you were confident that it wasn't a matter of somebody had measured things wrong? How did you really sort it out that it was an intrinsic variation rather than just somebody had their calibration wrong? Was it just confidence in the group's measurements?
Well, I'm not absolutely sure about this. What do you think? I did write one little paper about showing that there was a correlation with the coronal line.
Yes, right. So the fact that you had something else that was varying like that gave you some confidence that...
Yes, well, that was only discovered afterwards. We were doing these observations, quite a lot of them, really. The whole group was well queued up, on its experimental work. I suppose we did have a reasonable amount of confidence, didn't we? They seemed to vary in a pretty regular way when we
Okay.
I can't honestly remember that. How we reached it all out.
Now, another question I want to ask you is to what extent you were spurred on in your work by the theoretical models of, in particular, SMERD from Australia. Was that something that you were out to try to either see whether he was right or which one of his models were correct? Or?
Yes. Well, it was there was that Tanya had not discovered limb brushing.
Right.
And I can't remember the place at all, but he must have predicted limb brushing in the other wavelengths as well, but diminishing.
Well, I can't remember if he predicted it at such a long wavelength or not.
I think he may have predicted it at something like 1.4.
Yes, okay, that may be, yes.
Certainly there was... Smerd was a well-known, was a name that one heard in the department. From Tanya's work onwards, there was always the urge to see, how the experiments were tied with theory.
But what I'm trying to get at is that, as you look back at it, was that really your primary motivation to do this, to see whether this theory was right, or was it?
At that stage of radio astronomy, there was so many things to do.
You're just going to go out and do it and see what happened?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the comparison with theory, obviously, said all there simply was a hell of a lot, to do. And the sun was an obvious source of something to look at. So we looked at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the limb brightening, which was indeed an argument that raged in the early 50s as to what wavelengths it was at and was it there, and
yes.
Eclipse observations also, was really something that you looked at afterwards and commented upon. It wasn't something you said, all right, let's set up an experiment and see whether there's limb brightening or not.
I wouldn't say it was as that.